Having been squashed in windowless conference centres for the last 3 weeks, we're glad to say we're now back in our spiritual home at Guardian HQ in the palatial Studio One of King's Place.
We have got Georgina Henry and we've got Jenny Russell. Now, I want you two to admit, did you buy anything from the Harvey Nicks or the M&S at Tory Party Conference?
I did. I bought a pair of tights from the M&S store.
That's fine.
Harvey Nicks was rather expensive there, I thought.
Jenny?
Well, I sat there thinking, do I want a £525 Crombie coat? Funnily enough, I didn't have the small change on me, so I bought a bag of boiled sweets from M&S instead.
I mean, I sort of thought this is the death of the conference. You can't have shops here.
No, it was brilliant. It meant that at that moment when you were starving, you didn't have to walk 2 miles around the security zone to get a sweet to eat.
But everyone glad to be back in their own beds.
Gosh, yes. I mean, 3 weeks, I feel like I've emerged from a bubble, don't you?
There's nothing as horrible as British mid-level hotels, the kinds of ones we all get stuck in anyway. They're so depressing.
But whether we were miserable or not, the Tories should have been enjoying themselves because, of course, they're on the cusp of power for the first time in 13 years. But were they having fun? Simon Hoggart reports.
It's been a curiously downbeat conference, given that these people think that in a few short months they're going to be back in power after 13 years. Yet there was very little fizz. There was a champagne ban instituted that was broken, in fact, by the leader, sipping some rather fine Paul Roger white foil at a spectator party and late one night. But their party leadership is really terrified of people being complacent, of thinking, oh, okay, the government is absolutely hated, we're going to win, we don't need to do any work. And so they kept telling them, we've got a mountain to climb, it's going to be really, really tough, we've got to strain every sinew, use all our muscles to get there. And that gave the conference, I thought, a slightly downbeat air. David Cameron's speech, well, it was very Tony Blair-like, I felt. It was full of rather vague aspirations, so it was a little bit short on policy. It was the optimistic. He was being the good cop as opposed to the bad cop, his Shadow Chancellor, George Osborne, who on Tuesday gave a very, very downbeat speech in which he promised savage, terrible cuts, pay freezes, all was going to be absolutely horrible thanks to the Labour government. What Cameron gave himself was a job of saying, well, it'll improve. Things will, when we've been in power for a year or so, things will be absolutely rosy and marvellous and this country's going to be great to live in again. So it was kind of upbeat, but look, even that failed really to get the conference going. They applauded, they knew they had to, but there was a sense that they'd not been fired up. There's none of what Barack Obama called fired up, ready to go. It was sort of quite calm, waiting to go.
This makes Tom and I laugh because we didn't know Barack Obama called it fired up, ready to go.
Fired up, ready to go, yeah.
Yes, we can. Jenny, everyone was calling certainly Osborne's speech a gamble. Did you think it was a gamble? I thought it was quite. It's been floated for 6 months that he wanted to freeze public sector pay in some way.
I must say, I sat down to watch that speech with a normal sense of horror and resignation. I've never liked George Osborne. It's all that claret and steak stuff. And I thought it's going to be a very irritating speech by a man who's too young to be Chancellor. And I thought it was a very brave speech and a very good speech. And I fundamentally disagree with his economic policy. I think the Tories are completely wrong that they're going to slash public spending. And I think they're going to tip us deeply into recession. But within its own terms, I thought it was brave, it was honest. It made no cheap shots at Labour, which was a great relief for those of us who are used to sitting through all this kind of straw man jokes and bribe and barbs that you get in political speeches. And I think that people will have welcomed it because everybody I know knows that the country is in a mess. And just the fact that he was honest about what they were going to do and wasn't pretending, as I feel Labour had done the week before, that somehow there were some sunny uplands and we weren't really going to have to make hard choices, was a good thing for a Conservative to do at this point.
But George, what they weren't into at all was the kind of banks and the whole raft of stuff that brought us into this, isn't it?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, when you put together Osborne's speech with Cameron's yesterday, and there is just an extraordinary con going on here. There's this sleight of hand that actually the fault of the debt burden that the country is now following has nothing to do with bankers, which Cameron didn't mention yesterday. Osborne had a little bit about them, very small bit. That, you know, somehow it's the fault of the bloated government and the bloated public sector. I mean, brave speech. I mean, at the moment, it seems to me astonishing they're sort of getting away with this, although I did notice in some of the interviews with voters, you know, the people outside the bubble yesterday on Newsnight and other news programmes, you know, people were saying, well, you know, why is the message we have to pay for a mess created by others? And at the moment, you know, they seem to be getting along with that because they're getting a fantastically favourable press. But there are two issues here. One is, it is not the fault of public sector workers that the government is as indebted as it is right at the moment. We all know what it's about. It's about an enormous amount of money that has been put in to solve, try and stem the problems caused to us by an under-regulation. I mean, it's under-regulation. It's too little regulation, not too much regulation that's the problem there. And that seems to me just an extraordinary kind of thing to be going on there. And the, I mean, the other thing is the fact that, you know, they are still... you know, there is this thing about inheritance tax at the top. There is this sense that, you know, that's where their first big break is actually going to be. And it's not really about people at the bottom. So it's a sort of double whammy, isn't it? And I think it's absolutely amazing they're getting away with it.
Not saying that the election is theirs in the bag, but just suppose that this is the platform for any government that they do put together. I was at a party, I'm afraid, Age of Austerity, but I was at a party, and a really senior Tory, who's not a shadow cabinet member, but is very well respected and is quoted often, said, this is so foolish, and they're going to have, the first 3 years of a Cameron government will be running strikes all the time, and there will be schools closing, and they won't like it.
I think that is the key problem. I mean, we were talking about Osborne's speech. I thought it was in Cameron's speech that this great lacuna I opened up, in which he's talked about the problems facing the country being only those of big government. I think Georgina's absolutely right. I mean, Osborne has talked before about bankers' bonuses. I thought Cameron's speech was extraordinary in not mentioning the role of the markets at all. And I think that the whole problem for the Tories is that they've got a lot of microeconomic policies which appear to favour the poor, like saying we're going to protect people who earn less than 18,000 in the public sector. But their macroeconomic policy is just going to destroy great swathes of jobs and state support, which people who earn below the median depend upon. And that's a fantastic contradiction.
But there's also an economic argument going on. And if you read Martin Wolf in the FT this morning or other economists about whether or not it's the right strategy anyway to savagely cut from the minute they come in when the economy is still extremely fragile. I mean, there's a whole discussion out there. I mean, it's this odd thing where you've got the pink paper calling for carrying on of the state its role in propping up our financial system, our economic system. And you've got the politicians saying we must cut. I mean, it's usually the other way around, isn't it? It's the spend politicians and everyone cautioning. Great. So, I mean, I do think it's interesting to see whether or not they get away with it, in a way, whether or not this is going to convince people, or whether or not the Labour Party, which is what they ought to be doing, will seize the moment to say, this is shot through with contradictions.
Well, they're trying. But, the sort of contradiction neither of you really talked about is this one from yesterday's speech, which is sort of what everyone's written about this morning, which is you have him lavishing praise on the products of big government, but you have him saying, get rid of big government. Do you think that's...
Well, he likes some of the bits of big government, doesn't he? He likes the NHS, he likes Sure Start and so on. Yeah. But
he likes more of them than he was prepared to say he disliked, isn't it? I mean, Penn pushing back office bureaucrats, making policemen fill in forms, but...
Well, again, this is the enormous contradiction, because so much of the stuff that he deplored in his speech and that other people did, like... the gap that forces a single parent when they go back to work to lose so much in tax. He doesn't say, in benefit withdrawal, he doesn't say how he's going to deal with that. Now, if you're going to end those perverse incentives, that's going to cost a lot of money. Equally, if you're going to reform the public services, as he says, if you're going to get rid of a lot of people, if you're going to restructure things, that costs an enormous amount of money. And you just cannot do all those things that the Conservatives are setting out to do at the same time as slashing public spending. And I know that I was talking at the conference to people who are very senior in the city and are Tories and are absolutely petrified about the Tory economic policy, because they say it doesn't add up, it makes no sense whatsoever, and there's no need to cut the debt. In fact, it's the wrong thing to do at the pace that the Tories are trying to do it. And yet this economic literacy seems to have taken hold at the top of the party, and their minds won't be changed.
But one reason I think Cameron's speech worked quite well as a kind of polemic was because, unlike Brown's bitty kind of wonky speech we had last week, it had this central thread running right through it, which was all about debt. He's obviously... I mean, he might, regardless of whether it's right to cut now or not, he's probably figured that in the next parliament he's going to cut at some point. It might be easier to get that done sooner rather than later. And he's decided to give this tough message. Now, Jenny, you've in the past sometimes suggested that on benefits and other things, the Tories might have changed, might be prepared to find money. I mean, do you come away feeling much more pessimistic about what they're going to be prepared to do if their messaging is all about debt?
Well, I think the point is that they want to do some things to change the nation, and they are concerned about the poor, but they aren't seeing the contradiction between their micro policies and their macro policies. If you are going to slash the state, and if you are going to be running the economy into the ground, as I think they are going to be doing over the past couple of years, you're going to be creating social problems which you're not going to be able to solve. without spending money. So I think that's the problem, that I think their aspirations about ending poverty and improving the country and improving the plight of the lower paid and so on is genuine, but it doesn't add up.
Well, we've been concentrating on what the Shadow Cabinet wanted us to talk about, but what about the activists? What were they talking about? John Harris went out and about in the conference centre.
Philip Blom, Tory guru, take me to the sunlit uplands of the future Conservative utopia. Give me some adjectives. What words would you use?
I'd say a society where you take responsibility and you exercise power, a society where you come together with your fellows to control your street, your neighbourhood, your town and your village and your community, a society where it's a society.
This is that swelling incidental music. You're making me cry.
I want to convert you. Oh, you should join us, John.
Oh, you'll have a job.
Yeah.
You see, the great thing about the Tories, which Guardian readers should understand, is that conservative means deliver liberal ends.
Okay.
This is my manifesto.
So I've got nothing to lose but my own prejudices.
You've got nothing to lose but your own prejudices.
Much more independent, vigorous schools, stronger families, very active voluntary organisations. All of these things will matter much more. The state and the market won't be the first resort for tackling
social problems.
The revival
of civic society.
It will be these things.
Tell me what you think mended Britain might look like.
Perfect, like you.
I'm melting inwardly.
Shocking. That was Alan Duncan flirting with John Harris. George, have they drunk the Kool-Aid? Do they really believe this? Or is this just a song that sounds convincing and they're singing it?
No, I mean, I thought they really were hungry this week. And I think they really think they've cracked it, this idea that you can be a Tory and also you care more about poverty than, you know, the Labour people and so on. And of course they are helped, because let's face it, Labour's statistics in many respects are looking awful. It's a very, very effective line when Cameron turns to the cameras and says, don't lecture us about poverty, inequality's grown, you know, there are all these children. It's a very strong bit. And I think they feel they're poised for power. And there was nothing about this conference, by the way, that I felt would disillusion them of that. I mean, there is this sort of hole, I personally think, at the heart of this sort of the debt economic stuff. And also it is a powerful assault on the state. But and there are contradictory messages there. But I think there's a lot in the speech that people would have liked about personal responsibility and about where the state steps over the line. I mean, let's face it, it's a huge Guardian agenda about civil liberties. And, you know, there's too much kind of, you know, the surveillance state and all this sort of thing. And there's a very strong, classic sort of liberal argument with it. And I think all of that resonates quite well. It may be disingenuous. The state isn't responsible for the way in which its powers are sometimes abused. But often the government's been very slow to understand why people find that so offensive. And it was a very strong message, I thought, for
Jenny, the sort of mechanisms. When I sort of, I didn't mean have they drunk the Kool-Aid, and I wasn't trying to be patronising to them. But have they, is it fully thought out, you know, that you, I don't know, you give tax breaks to a charity and they'll assume the role that the state once did? I mean, the mechanisms, are they quite in place that will deliver this kind of little, this field of little platoons that Cameron thinks he wants?
No, I don't think they're in place, and the Conservatives know it. When you talk to people close to the centre of it, they know they're embarking on a grand experiment and they don't quite know how it's going to work yet. The one thing they feel is that what they've had so far doesn't work, and they know that when they talk about this responsibility stuff with all these examples recently in people's heads, like the police women stopped by Ofsted from looking after one another's children while they were on shift, you can't imagine a better arrangement for anybody, and yet the government steps in and says there might be something suspect about this, you can't do it. That kind of stuff resonates very deeply, and so do people's experiences of the state being very unresponsive over the past 10 years to what people really feel and need. They feel that the state very often has been a kind of bureaucratic machine delivering what it's decided is needed, which doesn't equate with what people want in their lives, whether it's people being nice to you in benefit offices or nurses caring for you in hospitals. And I think when George says that the state hasn't been sufficiently responsive and the government hasn't been responsive enough to people's desire for more responsibility, I think it's even worse than that. The government just doesn't get that agenda, actually.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true, actually. I mean, I think sometimes ministers are pulling their hair out in about the way in which the interpretation of what was a reasonable thing. I mean, the Ofsted arrangement being case in point, you know, if you talk to Ed Balls, he would say, I can't believe this is crazy. This is not what we had in mind, etc. But maybe they haven't, you know, they've been too slow, perhaps, to understand that this is the way in which it's interpreted. But to go back to your point about whether the structure is there, I think that's a, you know, big if, and that's obviously what wasn't there in the speech yesterday about exactly what these structures are.
But what it means is we have a situation which the Tories have always said they won't repeat, where Blair wasted his first 3 years because he didn't really know what he wanted to do. I mean, obviously the intent is there, but the kind of delivery may not be.
Well, I think the education stuff seems to me, it's quite far advanced. Yeah. They've sort of worked it out. Whether or not, it's going to work is another thing, but I think it is quite thought about now.
And certainly the mood is very different. So I don't know if the rebranding or the more than that has been successful or not. We can certainly say that some things didn't go so smoothly that this week. Here's the Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Grayling.
I admire the work of General Danat and other senior generals who've done so much in Afghanistan, done so much to lead. I hope that this isn't a political gimmick. We've seen too many appointments to this government of external people where it's all been about Gordon Brown's PR. General Danat's an experienced figure. He rightly should be working alongside government. But I'm always suspicious of the government's motives when it does things like this.
And the trouble is, of course, that the gimmick in question wasn't one of Gordon's, but one of Dave's. The next day, Mr Cameron said that he was going to bring General Danner into his government as a defence minister. Red faces aside, George, how worried should we be, do you think, about having generals moving into Whitehall?
Well, I mean, it's a very controversial thing to have done. I mean, you know, mainly because Danet is such a kind of controversial figure. And I think there's a great deal of disquiet, both from where he's left and from, you know, from where he's going or whatever. I mean, there is obviously now, it's quite a well-practiced thing we know about Gordon's government of goats. That's what we call them, isn't it? Yeah.
Government
and,
of all the talents.
Yes, exactly. Government of all the talents. So you bring in people from the outside. Yes, exactly. So, I mean, it's not happened before. I think, Dan, it's interesting because it's extremely close to when he actually was in the army. We know that he's fallen out with the government very strongly, or rather he is very cross that they don't agree with him about what to do about Afghanistan. I mean, it's interesting as to whether or not the public would see this. Is it a good thing? I mean, generally there is, as we know, a huge reference for all things to do with the army, whether it's squaddies. I mean, you know, it gets the big cheers, so I don't know whether or not the generals do as well, but it could be quite a smart move. In fact, in spite of the fact that Grayling, you know, that's the best thing about that, because it just had this sort of
I think he was being honest.
Yeah, of course he was, but that's why it was such an effective gaffe, really, or such a terrible gaffe, because it's just
the end of his career.
But of course, every prime minister since the Second World War up until Thatcher had been in the army, hadn't they, Jenny? And you've just reminded me, Admiral West is in the government at the moment.
Yeah.
How important do you think this issue of the time difference is between when he left and when he takes up office?
I think this is a different position from normal, because it's not as if he's going to join the Conservative Party just to attack the government. There is a war going on. It is a very serious issue. It's going badly wrong. Nobody understands what to do about it, it seems. Cameron started his speech by talking about the fact that we are at war. This is a matter of the Conservatives are quite honest about the fact that they don't think they know enough about this issue. And you're taking this man in order to advise the people who are probably going to be the future government. So it seems it's not just a matter of being taken on for political advantage.
No, but it's because it's him, and it's because of what he has been saying about Afghanistan, and it is because he has been at odds with government over many things. So he is a much more political figure already. He's not some guy who just comes in knowing about wars and army strategy and all that
sort of thing. I can see all that. But I also think that the reason he's been at odds with the government is because he thinks the way they're prosecuting the war is wrong. Mm. And in a way, we all need to know about that.
Well, I mean, his view is not universally shared. That's the other thing about him.
I'm just going to take you on in a handbrake turn to some of their other friends who were invited to conference this week. George, you didn't write about it, but lots of your writers did.
No, it's been one of the most debated subjects, actually, on the Commenter's Free website.
Just to explain to our listeners, in case...
it's quite arcane. You need to know your history.
The visiting of the Polish and the Latvian politicians who were accused of having anti-Semitic past or links to parties that have those past.
Well, I mean, what ratcheted it up this week is obviously that they were built to appear at this fringe. The British Board of Deputies has now, as you know, written to Cameron, and we've reported that. And that means it's a fantastically sensitive issue for him to have the Board of Deputies, which to date actually hasn't said very much about it, but they're now obviously seriously worried about it, the more that comes to light about it. And also, to just very briefly, I think, you know, for the gay vote, Ben Summerskill deciding not to turn up at the first Pride of event, you know, but that's also extremely worrying. I mean, they've done everything they can to bury it this story. Personally, I think it's going to come back slightly to haunt them.
But Jenny, without being glib, is it is it something that, given the complications, a party 7 months away from hopefully winning an election should have steered clear of? Or was the political game for them of hugging these new European allies close greater?
I can't think what their calculation was, because I can't understand the logic for their leaving the centre-right grouping in the European Parliament anyway. I know that what they say as Tories is that it's not that we agree with the political opinions of these people who are on the fringe in any way, except that we don't want more powers in Europe, and that's the only reason why we've allied ourselves with them. But in the public mind, that message doesn't come across at all. It looks as if the Tories are associated with whatever looks suspect in these people's past. Now, I think George is absolutely right to say this isn't a simple issue. As soon as you start looking at what actually happened in Latvia, there's nothing simply good or bad about this. And in politics, we prefer to say this person's a good person, this person's a bad person. Given the complex history of what happened in Eastern Europe during the Second World War, it just isn't as straightforward as that. But I think the Tories got themselves into an almighty mess by aligning themselves with the far right parties. And I think it was a mistake, and God knows why they had these people at the conference.
Indeed. Well, that is it for this week. Thank you to Jenny Russell and to Georgina Henry for coming in, and to Francesca Panetta for producing. We'll be back next week. Till then,
goodbye.